Hello, everyone. This is Stephen Cohen with a prologue to episode 10, which deals with what to do in a toxic release emergency. I needed to make a major correction to something I said in the regular episode. In the regular episode, I stated that people should turn their forced air heat and air conditioning off in an emergency because you could draw toxic air into your house. This is actually incorrect. What I should have said was that any house equipped with ventilation systems, such as a radon mitigation system or some other active attic ventilation system, what you're doing is you're taking air from the house and you're pumping it outside. Therefore, you're causing negative pressure inside the house. And if you have negative pressure inside the house, air from the outside is going to come in and you could draw toxic chemicals into the house that way. But I just want to be sure everyone knows I was incorrect when I said forced air heat and air conditioning draw in outside air. However, this does not change my recommendation. My recommendation is still to evacuate as opposed to sheltering in place when you have a toxic air contamination emergency. Anyone who's been paying attention to the news will know that people have gone back to their homes and are complaining of being sick. So something is getting into their homes. Anyway, I apologize for the mistake and enjoy the episode.
What is up, world? This is Stephen Cohen with the Quantitative Investigations podcast. I think we're at episode 9, and today we are going to discuss what to do when you are faced with a toxic chemical spill near your home or near your office or wherever you may be. I'm here today with, of course, Goose the Engineer.
Woot. Goose in the house.
Was the woo-woo like your train whistle kind of thing? Or
That would be choo-choo.
All right.
And I would know. I'm a recording master, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
He is the recording master. Anything to eat today?
Cake cookies, which honestly kind of feels like offensive to the traditional cookie. Because it's a cookie and cake form, and I like my cookies soft as opposed to hard cookies, but these are like
really soft.
They're sticking together and stuff. It's like it's not great. So if you see Safeway cake cookies, just don't go for it. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were saying cake and cookies.
No,
you're saying cake cookies.
Yeah, they're literally cake cookies. Yeah.
Yeah, this doesn't sound appetizing.
There isn't even a good abbreviation for it because both start with a C. Cake cookies, cook cake. Cook.
Yeah.
Anyways, you should probably just do your podcast now. So.
Why? This is much more exciting.
Yeah. I had Chick-fil-A earlier, if that helps.
All right.
Okay.
That does help. I should say that neither Chick-fil-A nor Safeway sponsor this podcast.
Great. Yeah. Good.
All right. Okay. Just catching up on the last episode, I'd actually have to correct something I had said. When we were discussing the ozone hole, I said ozone holes at the poles are natural, which is where they are, because of the magnetic field concentrates at the poles, and I used the word equipotentials. I was incorrect. The magnetic lines that connect the poles that come out of the North Pole, go to the South Pole, are flow lines. So the flow lines concentrate at the poles. Equipotentials are lines that go perpendicular to the flow lines. So I, of course, had to correct that because, you know, I don't really feel like being wrong. But occasionally, we all make mistakes. So getting to the subject at hand, I felt the need to discuss this topic because this is in my wheelhouse of expertise. I am a certified safety professional with the Board of Certified Safety Professionals, and I also am a certified hazardous materials manager through the Institute of Hazardous Materials Management, All that means squat. What really means something is for 30 years, I've been working in waste. The first third of my career was in hazardous waste, cleaning up hazardous waste sites. And the second third primarily was radioactive materials, uranium, uranium mills, that kind of thing. I've been trained in personal protective equipment for many years now, and also in monitoring for hazardous materials and radioactive materials. So more importantly, though, I've actually been in front of hundreds of people trying to explain to them why there's a lot of contamination in front of their children's elementary school and try to keep them calm, but actually give them real information. That is the point of crisis communication, is to give people information that they can use. And we today do not have leaders that are even close to capable of communicating in a crisis. For example, there's the East Palestine, Ohio train derailment, which resulted in, I don't know how many cars, I'd say maybe 10 cars of vinyl chloride that derailed, released the vinyl chloride, and there was a whole series of actions taken after that. And the quality of the information coming out of the elected officials, especially Mike DeWine, is so pathetic, so useless. And people need real information, not political posturing. They need real information when there's a crisis. And we don't seem to elect people who are capable of this. So I am going to try and give you the information that you need for this and any other hazardous material spill. The one thing I want to point out where Mike DeWine has gone off the rails, one of his first complaints is that he couldn't believe that the train that was going through East Palestine was not labeled a high hazard flammable train. Well, the reason why he can't believe it is because he doesn't take the time to go through the regulations. The regulations for hazardous materials transport are through the U.S. DOT, the U.S. Department of Transportation. You can find them, 29 Code of Federal Regulations, so that's Title 29, Code of Federal Regulations, Parts 171, and it would go through at least 177, but 29 CFR 172 and 171, they really have the meat of probably what you want to see. And in 29 CFR Part 171, the definitions, here you have it, the definition of high hazard flammable train means a single train transporting 20 or more loaded tank cars of a class 3 flammable liquid in a continuous block, or a single train carrying 35 or more loaded cars of a class 3 flammable liquid. Okay, one thing you need to understand about DOT regulations, and these particular DOT regulations in 29 CFR Parts 171 through 177, these are the hazardous materials regulations. And DOT classifies hazardous materials in 9 classes. Class 3 is called flammable liquids. However, and we're going to go through what an SDS is, but when you look at the safety data sheet, or the SDS, for vinyl chloride, what does it say? It says it's a flammable gas. A flammable gas is a category 2.1 hazardous material. So because Mike DeWine didn't really bother to speak to someone who knows the regulations, there was no way that this train was going to be called a high hazard flammable train, because it didn't contain the right substances to be categorized as that. Another thing about hazardous materials transportation: there are certain types of people who are specifically trained in offering hazardous materials for transportation. I am trained in it, And I've been trained in a number of times in hazardous materials transportation. I would never myself offer up a hazardous material for transportation without having it checked by an expert. The people who do this are not only trained, but you have to be extraordinarily practiced. The regulations in 29 CFR 172, and you can look it up yourself, these are the hazmat tables. They're not easy to understand. You need a lot of practice in offering up hazardous materials for transportation. And then you need, not only do you have to be familiar with the tables, but there are people who are practiced with certain materials. For example, I offered up a shipment of radioactive materials for transportation at the end of 2022. I had it checked by an expert just to make sure I was doing it right. So the people who do this are very skilled and have a lot of practice, a lot of training. And the regulations that the DOT has promulgated over the years are detailed and complicated, but they do work. Yes, there was a derailment, and the rail company is going to need to answer for that. But just because Governor Mike DeWine didn't like the way something was categorized doesn't mean that there was actually something wrong. And he actually is just taking away from the issue. Why are you focusing on the way a train was categorized when you have vinyl chloride that's burning and contaminating waterways and contaminating soil and contaminating air? Why are you doing that? That's useless. You need people who are skilled in crisis communication. I happen to be one of those. And that's why I'm speaking with you today. So we're going to go through the steps. What happens if there is a toxic spill due to a train derailment near your house? What do you do? Okay. There are two things you can do. You can shelter in place, or you can evacuate. There's a third thing, which is being stupid, which is to go right near the accident site and shoot video. But stupidity is not something I'm going to try and cure today. I'm sure that's something Goose the Engineer would do.
I do it regularly. I'm stupid for a living.
Thank you.
You're so welcome. My pleasure.
Okay. So when you're given a shelter in place, and we're going to assume right now there's an airborne toxin like the vinyl chloride. So what you want to do is if you have an airborne toxin that's been released due to an accident and someone's trying to shelter you in place, sheltering in place for that kind of situation is not the same thing as sheltering in place for an active shooter. If you have an active shooter, close your doors, close your windows, grab your gun if you're smart enough to have one. All right? But if you're dealing with an airborne toxin, you have a complication. So not only do you need to close your doors, close your windows, but if you have a forced air ventilation system like forced air heat or forced air conditioning, which anyone who has air conditioning will be forced air, you need to turn that off. So because all you're going to do is draw the toxin in to your house, which is not what you really want. This poses a problem. Let's say you're in Minnesota in the middle of winter. You have forced air heat. There's an accident, and now you need to turn off your heat. Well, how long are you really going to be able to stay in the house? Let's say it's in the middle of summer in Texas, and there's an airborne toxin accident, and you have to turn off your air conditioning. What are you going to do? My advice to anyone in this situation, the first thing you should do is look to leave. Now, if you're in the middle of some really toxic plume, then the best thing you can do is stay in. But if you can get out, if you're upwind of the accident or crosswind of the accident and you're not in directly in a plume and you can get out, get out. Don't stay. It's just not easy to keep your house free. And oh, by the way, if it's the middle of winter and you turn off your forced air heat, but you have a fireplace, you cannot use your fireplace. You use your fireplace, you're going to draw a vacuum in your house because the air, you're going to have air going out the chimney. You're going to draw a vacuum. You will draw air in to your house and you draw toxins into your house. You don't want this. Okay. So let's say you're safely, sheltered in place, or you have evacuated to a safe place. The next thing you want to do, you want to download what is called a safety data sheet. You want to find out from the news what the toxin is, and then you go on the internet and you find a safety data sheet. Every chemical or every product made from chemicals is required, that's offered in commerce, is required to have a safety data sheet. This is OSHA hazard communication regulations. And safety data sheets have a lot of information. For example, the vinyl chloride safety data sheet, I'm looking at it now. It gives you the chemical names, it gives you the types of hazards, and it'll have certain other information like composition, but it'll also have information like combustion products and other information such as concentration limits that are allowable for people to be exposed. And if you look at the vinyl chloride safety data sheet, you'll find out that vinyl chloride is a pretty nasty substance. The one thing that struck me about this particular accident is that I had heard, and I haven't confirmed this, but I had heard that they ignited the trains with the vinyl chloride. So this is pretty interesting. At first, I thought this was pretty stupid. And I looked into it further, and I decided that it was probably the lesser of two evils. But let me tell you something. Both evils aren't necessarily good. If they hadn't ignited it, and you had large amounts of this vinyl chloride getting out. Remember, vinyl chloride's a flammable gas. Now, looking at the chemical properties of vinyl chloride, right, you want to look at the properties, and you want to look at the vapor density. And the vapor density is 2.2. That means anything over 1 is heavier than air. So therefore, you're going to have a large amount of vinyl chloride vapors that are going to leave the scene and they're going to migrate away at ground level. Because it's highly flammable, any sort of spark from a transformer, from switchgear, from a light switch, any sort of spark could ignite this. And then what you have is an air blast bomb. That's what a MOAB is, the Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb. You have from the military. You have one detonation that sprays out this flammable vapor, another detonation that ignites it. You get a huge pressure and thermal wave, and at ground level will be highly destructive. So what is the other? So the other option is to ignite it, or what they actually say, and I'm trying to find it here you go. If you have a leaking gas fire, do not extinguish. This is for vinyl chloride. If you have a leaking gas and it's on fire, do not extinguish it, unless you can stop the leak. You're to let it burn. So, you let it burn. And at least what you do is you know where the fire is, right? You know where the fire is. You know the fire's contained. If you didn't do that, you would then have a larger area with a massive blast. So the problem, though, is every single flammable substance that has chlorine in it, and vinyl chloride has chlorine in it, obviously, that's why it's the chloride. When It ignites, it decomposes to some pretty nasty things. One of them is phosgene, one of them is hydrogen chloride, and one is carbon monoxide. Hydrogen chloride is the gaseous form of hydrochloric acid. So when hydrogen chloride forms, it'll form hydrochloric acid with water vapor in the atmosphere, but if you breathe it in, it'll also form hydrochloric acid in your lungs, and then you will likely die from chemical pneumonia, and that is an extraordinarily horrible way to go. Phosgene is another of the combustion products, highly toxic, and we're going to go over that. So when you're looking to figure out what to do, you need to download these safety data sheets. And I've downloaded the safety data sheets for vinyl chloride and phosgene. It has a lot of information. Now, when you've downloaded these safety data sheets, you want to take a look at what are called exposure limits. There are various exposure limits. You'll see something that says OSHA PEL, which is a permissible exposure limit. Those are generally ignored because they're usually considered out of date. So what you want to look at are ACGIH, that's the American Council of Governmental Industrial Hygienists, and they have a threshold limit value, and or NIOSH, National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. So you really want to take a look at some of these limits, all right? And when the federal government or when your state government says that it's safe, what you want to do is you want to contact those people and you want to see how they know it's safe, what kind of readings they received. If someone has tested your home, you want to see the data. If your data shows that, for example, for vinyl chloride, the ACGIH threshold limit value is 1 part per million weighted over 8 hours. If your concentration exceeds that limit, you don't want to be in that house. You don't want to be in that house. There are other limits, and you would want to go to look at the pocket guide for chemical hazards. And I'm trying to find it. It's a NIOSH document. And I'm looking it up right now as you're hearing me type. Pocket Guide to Chemical Hazards, NIOSH. It's a website. It's www.cdc.gov/NIOSH. And you can go find this NIOSH Pocket Guide to Chemical Hazards. You can go search on vinyl chloride, which is what I'm doing right now. All right, I have searched on vinyl chloride. And when you look at it, you see other limits. Now, the one limit you always want to find is what's called the IDLH. This is the immediately dangerous to life and health. There's actually no limit listed that I can find on vinyl chloride, which is actually pretty interesting. However, you want to see what that limit is, because you want to know if someone has measured that limit and they're telling you it's safe, well, you know it's not safe. But it's important when someone says, oh, your house is safe, you need to know what that means. You need to know what the limits are. You need to know what they're measuring, or you're not going to know anything. The other thing when you want to look at and the SDS is to see if they have something called an odor threshold. For vinyl chloride, there's no odor threshold available. However, for phosgene, interestingly enough, there is. Why is the odor threshold important? The odor threshold right here, that's listed on this SDS, is 0.4 to 1.5 parts per million. That is the concentration at which a human being can smell that substance. here's where your problem is. All right? When you look at the threshold limit value for phosgene, time-weighted average, it's 0.1 parts per million. So if you're smelling phosgene, you are already above the occupational limit. Gets even worse for phosgene. Why is that? Goose, you're asking? Why is that worse?
I simply couldn't tell you, but I hear you clicking around, which means that the answer is on the way.
Yes, I am. I am clicking around. I am doing this live just to show people that I'm not full of poop. Or maybe I am.
Well, yeah, you are, but it's just not related to...
So remember,
podcast.
Remember what I told you. The odor threshold for phosgene is 0.4 to 1.5 parts per million. The immediately dangerous to life and health limit is 2 parts per million. So by the time you are smelling phosgene, you are getting close to the immediately dangerous life and health limit. That means at 1.5 parts per million, you are going to feel some effect. And because the nose isn't that sensitive, I don't know anyone who can tell the difference between 2 parts per million and 1.5 parts per million. That's all I can tell you. But you need to know, you need to look at these documents, you need to know with what you are dealing, you need to understand what the agencies are telling you. And if they're not giving you specific information, then you cannot assume that your house is safe. You can't. Now, what do you do then? So, if you can't rely on the government, which increasingly you can't, unfortunately, there are some measures that you can take. If they're telling you that it's safe, then what you could do is you could go back to your house and sample the air. And mind you, right now I'm just dealing with air toxins because quite frankly, those are more dangerous and harder to deal with. Soil and contaminated water are easier to deal with because it takes more time. And plus, when it comes to water supply, there are a number of things to account for, which I will try and cover that here. But you can go on to a website called Grainger, right? Grainger.com. They sell all kinds of products. And what you want to look for, and quite frankly, it's probably be better if you call them up. You want to look at something called Draeger tubes. Draeger tubes are glass tubes with a reagent in them. You hook them up to a special Draeger pump, and you pump the air a specified amount of time. It draws air into these tubes. The contaminant reacts with the reagent in the tube, and you can get a reading on the contaminant of interest. There is a phosgene one. There is also a volatile organic compound one. There might even be a vinyl chloride specific one. Find the Draeger tube. You go back to your house, and you go ahead and sample the air and see what it says. If, however, I wouldn't necessarily do this without protecting yourself. And how would you protect yourself? Well, you would have an air purifying respirator. For vinyl chloride, and there are certain cartridges that you would put on your air purifying respirator. And I would also actually suggest a full face one as opposed to a half face one. So you're protecting your face because some of these substances like vinyl chloride could not only be an inhalation hazard, but it could also be a skin and eye absorption hazard. What you want to do is you want to make sure that your respirator is equipped with compound HEPA filter and a volatile organic cartridge filter. So it's one filter, it's compound, it's volatile organics, which is basically activated carbon, and a HEPA filter for dust. It's a combined cartridge. You put those on your respirator. I'm not sure if that would work for Phosgene, but if you call Grainger, by the way, I am not being sponsored by Grainger, but I just know they're helpful. There are other suppliers that you can try. But I'm on the Grainger website right now, and I know they have the Phosgene Draeger tubes. So you can arm yourselves with these, go to your house, and collect samples. And if something isn't right, at least you have the evidence. And you won't need to take the government's word for it. But, for example, in East Palestine, when they're saying they've tested the air quality, no one on the news is saying for what chemicals they've tested. Is it just vinyl chloride? Is it phosgene? Is it hydrogen chloride? What about carbon monoxide? Carbon monoxide is also a product, and that's a deadly asphyxiant. These are things you can do to help yourselves. I never recommend it. I do not recommend ever going back to a house before anyone says that it's cleared. If you go back in the middle of the emergency, I promise you, you're going to put yourself in a world of hurt if you don't know what you're doing. All right, I know what I'm doing. I know what protection I would need to go into a chemical situation. But most people don't. However, the SDSs will tell you that. They will tell you what types of protection you need for handling these chemicals and responding to them. In some cases, they may say fully encapsulated suits when responding to, say, an emergency or a fire. Some of these chemicals are really nasty. But the SDS and your NIOSH website are going to be your best friends in understanding what toxins you're dealing with. Okay, so what do you do again when they say it's safe? If you don't believe the government, then arm yourselves. To me, what I'm hearing from the reporting on this East Palestine derailment is that the government's saying it's safe and people are still getting sick. Well, how is that? How is that possible? It's only possible. It's only possible if they're not sampling for all the potential chemicals. And don't forget, this was a train. The train was on fire. So not only are you getting the vinyl chloride burning, there could be other substances and other flammables that are burning too. You may not know the full extent of what is burning. So, hey, Goose, am I covering everything? You think you're ready to handle this?
I'm ready to take on everything you're talking about. I could not be more ready. It's invigorating stuff.
I love when people lie right to my face.
Well, it's not right. There's glass between us.
You know? Oh, man. You know, we actually have a guest in the studio, a certain Caleb, but he's not saying anything.
No, he's also listening. He's just, you're rendering him speechless, sir. It's a lot to take in all at once, you know?
Am I rendering him speechless or asleep?
Does that answer your question?
All right. Okay, so I think we've covered air toxin emergencies. I'm sure there's something I'm missing because I am kind of spitballing today. Let me just go through my. By the way, if anyone does want to know what the various USDOT hazmat classes are, you can just look online. The US DOT, and this is through the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. They have various brochures and documents that explain what the various classes are. So, yeah, it's something that I had to memorize, and I tried forgetting it as quickly as I needed to because it was killing my brain. But I think we're good there. Now, let's talk about groundwater, or should I say water. So this train derailed next to a stream. And obviously chemicals are going to get into a stream. Obviously, there's going to be some emergency response necessary. But everyone has to understand, the safety of people is going to come before the safety of environment. You can't sit there and divert resources to save fish when people's lives are in danger. Streams will recover from these accidents. They will recover. But you need to understand, that safety of people comes first. Now, let's say you have all this chemical that gets released and soaks into the ground. Some chemicals migrate through the ground faster than others. If you have a water well that's in the area, and this all depends on the geology, so it's very site specific. Just because you have a water well in the area doesn't mean the aquifer from which it's pulling has any reasonable connection to the surface. Doesn't mean that. There are various types of aquifers, and I can do a whole segment on hydrogeology if you want, but that would put both Goose and Caleb to sleep.
Oh no.
So you really need to be calm when it comes to water contamination. First, you need to understand where your water supply is. If you have a city water supply, you need to understand where the reservoirs are. You need to understand how a surface water body connects up to the water treatment plant, to the reservoir or water, and then goes into the water treatment plant, and how that translates into your drinking water. You need to understand that. That's a phone call to the water treatment plant. The water sanitation district, whatever is in charge of supplying you drinking water, if it's municipal water, you call those people. Vinyl chloride is a volatile organic compound. So actually, if you're going to have a spill of a toxic chemical, that's probably one of the better ones, because it's more easily removed from water. Basically, agitating it will stir it up, and then it'll off gas. And they have treatment systems that are called air strippers, where water comes in from the top, air comes is blown up from the bottom, blows off the volatile organics, and then it goes to through some catalytic converter that actually destroys the vapors. So it's relatively easy. Now, the other thing you're going to get, though, when you have smoke is air deposition. So that smoke is going up. When you have a fire, that smoke is going up. And when you have a vapor release, those vapors and that smoke are going up, but they are going to settle. You have to figure out where it settles. You can yourselves call up a laboratory, call up any chemical or environmental laboratory, and ask them how to collect a sample and send it to them, and you can pay to have your soil analyzed. Now, it's not going to be cheap in some cases, but you will get answers on whether or not your soil is contaminated. This is if the cleanup people aren't going to do it and you need to confirm. You can do all this yourself. You can call up an environmental laboratory, tell them the issue. They'll tell you what, they'll send you sample bottles. You can collect the sample and send it off and have it analyzed. They'll also tell you pretty much how to collect the samples. Water samples are tricky because if you have volatile organics, you need to collect them in a very specific way in order to get an accurate measurement. I don't know if a lab is going to tell you how to do that or not, but it's very tricky for volatile organic water sampling. But the most important thing is you can't assume if your stream gets contaminated or there's a chemical spilled on the soil, you cannot assume immediately that your water supply is contaminated. You cannot assume that. You need to do some investigation. Now, when it comes to soils in general, if soils are contaminated, generally what happens is they're excavated and removed. However, with organic chemicals, all you really need to do, in many cases, is landform them, where you excavate the soil, you put a plastic sheet over it, and then you let the microbes eat the organic compounds. I've done this. It works great. But soil remediation is feasible. And again, with your water, you just have to remain calm. If you have a well, though, and it's a shallow well, what I can tell you is chlorinated solvents and chlorinated compounds like vinyl chloride and trichloroethylene and others, they will go through soils quicker than water. And if, let's say, you have tight soils that are clay, somehow it'll still get through those clays. So if you have a shallow well and you have such a spill like that, you could have a contaminated well. You could get it tested yourself. Again, all you have to do is call a laboratory. Anyway, this was a pretty short one, right? I haven't been blabbing on that long, right, Goose?
No, I don't think so. I took my glasses off, but I want to say it says 39 minutes.
All right, that's probably enough. So in the end, to summarize, if you're faced with a toxic contaminant in the air from some kind of catastrophe, some kind of disaster, my recommendation is to not shelter in place. If you can get out, get out. Get to someplace safe. Find out what chemicals, and not only chemicals that were being carried, but what potential combustion products are, and the SDS will list that for you. Look at the SDSs, see what the limits are. Try to understand the nature of the chemicals. If they say it's safe and then you want to go back, you can get yourself some Draeger tubes, and they make many kinds. They should, for most industrial chemicals, they should have a Draeger tube that can be used for analyzing the air. Make sure you're protected with an air purifying respirator. You have to have the right cartridges. Again, if you call Granger, they can also help you with picking out the right cartridges for your respirator. If you're dealing with a chemical that is known to absorb through the skin, you're going to want to have some kind of Tyvek suit. You know, people may make fun of you. You may look like, you know, you're on the moon or something, but better safe than sorry. And go ahead and take your Draeger tubes. If you're worried about your water, and if you have municipal water, the first thing you need to do is call your water treatment plant. And they actually are required to tell you what analysis they're doing and whether or not they're detecting anything. Because don't forget, the source of your water could be far from where the actual pollution is. Soil contamination, you can go ahead and call a laboratory. You can get your soils tested. It's not going to be cheap. Testing for organic chemicals in soils could cost $700, $800 for the volatile organics and semi-volatile organics. It's not cheap. But it could put your mind at ease. And when you're also looking at contamination, anything that is... any contaminant that's deposited through air deposition is not going to be very deep. Soil contamination due to a liquid contaminant like liquid vinyl chloride going through the soil column, obviously it's going to be deep. But over time, that is actually going to degrade through biological activity. So I think I have sufficiently covered this topic. And if not, please let me know. Thank you very much, Colorado Springs. Where's my end bumper music?
It'll come in the post-production, you know. So right. Now you've kind of ruined it, though, because I'm going to be talking through. Like, the outro is playing right now, and I'm talking, and it's playing right now. We just haven't put it in yet. And now I'm in a feedback loop because I'm still talking, and it's still playing. So.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Again, this is Stephen Cohen for Quantitative Investigations from the metropolis of Colorado Springs, bidding you a fond, Averdurchy.